Good morning, everybody. My name is Cushing Phillips. I'm an alcoholic. I used to be a gutter drunk. By the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the example of people like you, I haven't had to live that way since April 7th, 1988, and for that I am profoundly grateful. Lots of stuff up here. I would truly like to thank Ruth and the committee for the invitation to be with you. I'm not a circuit speaker. I'm like the guy at your local home group that comes in on Friday night and you know, regurgitates self-indulgence all over you. And so I just wanted to set the bar low. But it has been truly a joy to be here this weekend with some people that I have known almost as long as I have been sober, and some people that I am just now meeting, and some wonderful people that I hope will become fast friends in the years ahead. One of my heroes, I have heroes in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of my heroes told me one day to mark the places that I find God and to go there often. And so I hope I can be here often, because I have found God all over the place this weekend, and I want to thank you very much for that. I do want to do one little thing, and it's sort of preliminary to this evening, and I'm going to try not to get too far away from the pickup on the mic, because you don't want to miss none of this. And I would like to ask all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have been continuously and without interruption sober for 1 year or longer, if you would just raise your hands, just real quick. Wow, there is some sobriety in this room. I am so grateful that y'all are here this morning, because every time you show up to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you continue to inspire me and you continue to give me an example to follow. And if it wasn't for your example, I wouldn't be here. But my message really is for those of you with less than a year, with 6 months or 9 months or 27 days for the 14th time. You don't ever have to take another drink, even if you want to. That's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a chronic relapser. I was the guy that came into the meeting and left 5 minutes before the prayer because I needed a drink. And you people said, keep coming back. It works if you work it. And I kept coming back, and you were right. And I'm grateful. I'm not supposed to be here at all, actually. I'm not supposed to be an alcoholic. People in my family are not alcoholic. Don't get me wrong. My parents were daily drinkers. My dad would come home from the office and he'd mix a couple of cocktails using a jigger to measure the alcohol. I didn't know what that thing was. And he and my mother would sip a drink while they talked over their day, and my dad changed out of his, you know, and then we would all gather around the family table for dinner, my sister and myself, and then later my younger sister, who was born when I was 9 years old. I never did like her. And I won't go into a lot of it, but I just want to, if you've ever seen Leave It to Beaver, hi. We go to university, well, I went to jail. We go into the professions. I broke into people's homes. We get married and stay married and have families and join churches and join civic groups, and we give back to our communities. I was stalked by the police because I was a known felon. I'm not supposed to be here. Because at the end, I woke up sometime around the crack of noon, and I poured 16 ounces of cheap wine in a glass, and I drank it down as fast as I could. And as that wine cut through the brown stuff in my mouth from the night before, and it filled my soul, and I could breathe, and the whole world backed up 10 feet. And that's how I live my life. Now, I want to do good service to the newcomers and to the early timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my first drink when I was 8 years old. It was the occasion of the retirement of the rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in Ithaca, New York. In the fellowship hall, they had adult punch, and in the Sunday school rooms, they had kids' punch, orange juice, grapefruit, whatever it was. And at 8 years old, I came to the very wise decision that it was time for me to grow up. I was tired of being a child. I needed to be an adult. And so me and a couple of my other equally advanced cronies, we started sneaking drinks from the adult punch. You know, we didn't have fake IDs yet, so we had to wait till one of you, well, not one of you, but one of them left a half a glass sitting on the table. And we'd slide it up, and we'd scoot on around the corner, and we'd pass it around, and, you know, white wine or champagne punch, I don't know what it was. And I learned a couple of things. The first thing I learned is that if you have a limited amount of alcohol, do not share. Do not share. The second thing that I learned is that if you do not have the ability to get a drink, somebody may leave a half of one on the table. It's just as good if you hit a couple of tables. And the third thing that I learned once I started to follow your program of action and I began to look backwards is that from the very first time that I put alcohol into my body, I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, until something or somebody stopped me. That's how I always drank. That night, Mama caught on and, you know, took me out of the fellowship hall and took me home, probably lectured me, I don't remember. In future days, I ran out of money, I ran out of luck, I ran out of freedom, I ran out of bars, I ran out of a lot of things. But I never ran out of thirst. You know, I'm certain across my life I have drank too much. But I'm equally certain across my life I have not drank enough. No matter how much, how hard I tried, I just need one more, man. Give it in a go cup. I'll leave. I swear, man, could you buy me a drink? Take a check. I believe to this day that I haven't had enough to drink. And I hope to God I never find out. Because I don't think that I would survive. But I know that I'd live. And if I'm not terribly afraid of getting drunk and dying. But the thought of getting drunk and living, that terrifies me. And so I became a gutter drunk at the age of 8. Well, no, that took a little work. Anything worth doing, it takes a little effort. But what did happen is that I began to be a part of the world. You know, up until then, my world was small. It was my family and a few kids right around the house, and it was the church, and it was, you know, kindergarten and nursery school and probably the first grade and the second grade. And my world began to get bigger, and then we moved, and it was a bunch of new people, and it was them. And I don't know about you, but them always seemed so frightening. They seemed like they knew something that I just didn't know. And they seemed like they understood things that I would never understand. And so I had to begin trying to impress them. I had to make them think that I was better than them. Because then they'd want to be my friends. Because everybody I wanted to be friends with I thought was better than me. And so I began to tell lies. I mean, not like get out of trouble lies. I understand those. You know, that's what you tell the police or your ma. But I mean lies like I don't know what happened, but I had to have plastic shin implants. Who says something like that? I don't understand. But it just came natural, and I became an inveterate liar. And you move on a few years, and I'm getting up into fifth grade and sixth grade, and I'm trying to really, really win. There was somebody not too long ago talking about winning, and I understood that, you know? And so I wasn't sure I could do it on my own merit. I mean, I'm not athletic. I'm sort of bright, but I don't like doing work. And so I figured there was an easier, softer way, and so I became a cheater. And so I'm going into sixth grade and seventh grade, and I'm a liar and I'm a cheat. And now I really need to begin impressing you people because, you know, you really expect so much out of me. And so I needed 10 bucks or 20 bucks or 50 bucks or the silver or the jewelry or the bank card. And I became a thief. And so I enter seventh and eighth grade, and I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And that was the year I began to add alcohol in earnest. And I became a liar, a cheat, a thief, and a drunk. And it was the youth group trip or the acolytes on Saturday afternoon or Victor and Beth's parents go out of town, so 200 of their closest friends or a kegger at the frat house when I'm 15 or 16. And it's good. I mean, you know, I loved what Billy shared the other night. Is, you know, my best day drunk was pretty good, you know? I don't remember, but it must have been good. Excuse me, I can't drink too much or I'll have to leave early. And so I'm you know, sort of skimming through life and skimming through school, and I'm telling lies, and I'm cheating every chance I get so that I can win, and I'm stealing money so I have money to spread around. That came in handy later when I was buying drinks at the bar. And I'm getting drunk two nights a week, three nights a week, three nights in a morning, four mornings. By the time I was a senior in high school, I was intoxicated seven mornings a week, and I stopped going to class. And I was disenrolled from Pittsburgh Public Schools for lack of attendance. I missed 45 out of the first 50 days of my senior year. If that's for me, take a message. I didn't see a problem. I was smarter than all of them. I put on a pair of blue jeans. I put on my little dope dealer jacket, and I went down to the school barefoot with my books, and I slung them across the desks because I don't need you. I was arrogant. Still am. And so I moved back home. I was living at home, and I was going to go to a private school for a little while because my parents believe in education, and they wanted what was best for me. They were trying to control my life, and they were trying to tell me who I had to be and what I had to do. And so they sent me to private school, but I didn't go to class there any better than I did in public school. And so my parents cut off tuition and robbed me of an education. And I'm living under my father's roof, and as long as I live under my father's roof, I will do as my father tells me to do. So I moved out from under my father's roof because I didn't need them. I just needed their checking account. And I moved in with some friends of mine, and I got a job with the Census Bureau, but they don't hire you long if you don't show up for work. And I'm living in this apartment paying my rent because I call my mommy and I say, can you loan me, you know, that parental loan that really doesn't have a payback schedule? And in the meantime, I'm breaking into people's homes. I could appreciate Chuck's story about having the, I didn't have that big of a family, though, so I just, you know, ripped off my parents' friends because I figured if they caught me, they'd be too embarrassed to press charges. I was wrong. And life began to get a little crazy, but it's still, it was a party, you know, it was good, it was fun. I think at that point I was a normal person. Because for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. And it was. Oh, it was. I thought I had the world by the tail. Little did I realize what comes out from under that tail. What I didn't know was that the only time I experienced any of those things was when I was drinking. If I didn't have a drink, I couldn't talk to you, I couldn't go any place, I couldn't do anything, and I'm 18 years old. And so my parents moved to Montgomery, Alabama. I was living in Pittsburgh at the time, and I got into a little trouble because I ran out of neighbors and parental friends, and so I ripped off my roommates. That's not a good idea. I don't recommend it. I crawled out of a third-story window, broke into the apartment next door, and made it to the street. I went over someplace to a payphone, and I called my mommy. And I said, Pittsburgh's a little bit of trouble. I need some money to pay off Mellon Bank. Because what I had stolen was blank checks, and they said if I paid back the money that I took by forgery, that they wouldn't throw me in the penitentiary. And I thought that was a good deal. So Mother sent me a money order made out to Mellon Bank, and she sent me a one-way, non-refundable, non-transferable, non-exchangeable bus ticket to Montgomery, Alabama. God bless her. And I arrived. And I'm living in Montgomery, Alabama, and there I was. And it took me about a week and a half to find the people like me and to find the clubs that I like. And I didn't have a car, so at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm pushing Mother's car down the driveway so I can go out joyriding in a Dodge Aspen station wagon, because I'm cool. And then, the police arrest the Dodge Aspen station wagon and me on the 20-yard line of the high school football field. About 2 weeks after that, my dad got a note in the mail. Apparently, she'd called the cops, anyway, this woman, it wasn't just the football field. We'd gone four-wheeling in that station wagon, and she just wanted somebody to replace the swing set I'd taken out in her backyard. I'm grateful that I drank at 3 a.m. instead of 3 p.m. when there would have been children on that swing set, because I wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have cared. I would have hated going to prison for vehicular manslaughter. That would suck. I'm not prison material. But someplace along the line, maybe forever, I don't know, I just never could see how my life and my actions affected you. I didn't care what your life looked like. I didn't care what you were going through. I didn't care what you needed. All I cared about was what I needed from you and what you had that I wanted, and what you had that I didn't have, and that wasn't fair. And I grew up in this wonderful family. Christmas, big deal. My father's favorite holiday. And the tree's the same tree, and the little wax candle that looks like a Christmas tree with the little ornaments stuck in on pins. And the stockings are all hung in order, and the same smells, and the same foods, and the same laughter and joy that they had. And what I remember is Christmas morning going down to that tree, and my sister got more than me. And Mama liked the gift she bought her more than she liked the one I bought her. Now, I don't think that's what really happened, but that's what I believed. Belief is a strong thing. And I walked through my life believing that my father was 30 feet tall and nuclear proof, never mind bulletproof. I mean, he was doing tests on Bikini Atoll after the Second World War. I walked through life believing that my mother loved my sisters more than me. I walked through life believing that God wanted too much. I walked through my life believing that my father could never be pleased. I walked through life believing that I was a piece of dirt. And I don't know why. Nobody ever told me that. Nobody. It's funny, I come into these rooms and I meet you people and I hear your stories and some of you, that was drilled into your head. We heard that share yesterday and it breaks my heart. But look, my experience was absolutely the opposite. And here I am. Go figure. I guess the problem's me. You can go, I'll give you a little break, come on. I love her, she's just so cute. And so I'm living at Mama's house and she's unreasonable anyways and she doesn't really like me a whole lot, so she has that talk with me one morning and she's, Cushion, you need to get a job and move out or just move out. I won't let you destroy this family anymore. God, I hated her. I mean, she cut my legs right out from under me. What was I supposed to do? I had hair down to here. I had no GED. I had no chances. Nobody was hiring senior executive vice presidents. I had asked them, don't you want to give me a job? And people had said, no, not really. And so I became an enlisted seaman in the United States Navy to protect my country and to serve my flag. Aren't you feeling safe now? And 3 years later, 3 years shy of the end of my enlistment contract, I was honorably discharged for the convenience of the government for becoming an administrative burden to the command. I didn't like authority. I didn't like rules. I didn't like waking up. I didn't like not getting drunk on shore leave. I didn't like having to deal with shore patrol. I didn't like a lot of things, you know. That's my problem all my life, is just the world has not suited me. If you people would just dot, 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 dot. And so they asked me if I would like to exit military service under Project Upgrade. I said, does it mean that I can't get any benefits? And they said, no, you're evaluations are good enough, you'll get some benefits. I said, where do I sign? And I came home, spent a little bit of time with my half-brother in the mountains of North Carolina, went through whatever money I had in the bank, and moved back to Montgomery, Alabama. I managed to stay in Montgomery, Alabama for about 3 years after that. I was working at Auburn University, Montgomery, but 1 year the pay raise that they gave me was only 4.5% instead of 20%, which I deserved. Don't they know who I am? Ray Wells was the first man, he was my boss, that ever talked to me about drinking. Before this, it was always behavioral problems. That's what people noticed. But now they were talking to me about my drinking. And I would come in looking and smelling like I just left a bar, because I just left a bar. And he would shake his head. And Ray was this type A personality. And when he'd get angry, that vein in his forehead and his all red. And he's about 200 pounds overweight anyway. And it just, you know, don't stroke, Ray. Don't stroke. But when he had that talk with me, the vein wasn't there, and the red face and the steam out of his ears, it was concern. I couldn't see that at the time because I didn't allow myself to see the love and the concern and the compassion that the world had for me. I didn't allow myself to see all of the chances and opportunities that they kept trying to give me. All I could see was what I didn't have. All I could see was what I didn't get. All I could see was what I wanted. And so a couple of months later, I turned in my letter of resignation for personal and professional growth. I find it necessary. And I moved to Birmingham to a flop house and got a job as an assistant manager trainee at a fabric store. That was my personal and professional growth. My favorite bar was 6 blocks from the apartment because there wasn't 15. And I began drinking in earnest. This time I didn't make conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. I began to run short of funds to pay my bar tab. I began to feel lonely. I became a whore. And the cycle was full. And I began to experience pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, because I did whatever I had to do to get what it was I needed. And I was ashamed, and I couldn't say it out loud. But that's what I became. I got fired from that job for drinking. Imagine that. You'll need to come back and talk to the store manager about your job. But you know, I can stand toe-to-toe with anybody and lie to them but when I'm busted, I can't even look at their shoes, because I'm a coward. And so I left that job, and I drank up what little money I had in my pocket, and I picked up the phone and I called my mommy. Birmingham didn't work out. Can I come home? Yes. God bless her. She never did find Al-Anon. That's really sick that there's a part of me that's extremely grateful for that. I guess I'm still more concerned about me than I was about her. So I come back to Montgomery, and I end up working in a second shift job. And if you're not done drinking, second shift is great, because you don't have to wake up until noon anyway. And I'm living in the Hilltop Arms in a little efficiency apartment, pull-down Murphy bed, little half kitchen, little half bath, little half life, when that gallon jug of Carlo Rossi Rhine wine started appearing in my refrigerator that I alluded to earlier. And sometimes I made it to my bed, and sometimes I passed out in my car, and one time I came to riding the elevator up and down in that building. But wherever I came to, I managed to make it back to my little refrigerator and to that bottle of wine, because I needed that to face the world. I don't know how I got here. I don't know what happened. One morning I woke up and there was no wine in my refrigerator, and there was no money in my pocket. And so my car was broken down in the parking lot, so I hoofed it a couple of miles to Mama's house because I needed some Cheerios. And while I was there, I took 10 bucks out of my little sister's wallet because I needed a drink more than I needed her respect. And as I walked away from the house, I knew the jig was up. I knew when they found that money gone one more time. I mean, it's already the case that if they feed me, they feed me on the back porch because mother can't keep an eye on me. To the day she died, my mother could give you an insurance company eligible itinerary or list of everything of value in her home and where it was, down to the spare change in the sofa. I made it necessary for her to learn how to do that. And so I'm coming back from with this 10 bucks in my pocket, and I get afraid. And so I turn around and I go back to her house and I hand her the money and I cry because I'm really good at that. And I say, I want some help. And 3 days later, I landed in a medical facility for treatment of addictive disease disorder. Now, I got to tell you, and this is sort of a little soapbox, so just ignore it. It's just my opinion, but it should be yours too. My 3 years in the United States Navy had done something for me. Coming up through high school, I would have thought I qualified for many different sources and avenues of help. But they had said, random your analysis. I said, Jack and Coke, and we were set. And I never had any question after that about what was wrong with me. Well, I didn't know, but you know what I'm saying. And so when I arrived at the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have to question that. The only "and"s I ever had were "and something to make you laugh," because I do like making people laugh. It's how I keep you from hitting me. What I wanted to share on that, though, is that there are many people who come to our rooms, who come in through whatever facility they come in, that don't know. That maybe you're a little bit of everything, an NEO, as Tammy likes to say, or maybe they think that this is their problem, but they're told, well, just tell them that this is your problem, and it doesn't matter what your challenge is. What matters is that you know what it is, and that you find your tribe. Because if I had walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and you people were talking about these cakes that you used to eat 5 and 6 at a time, I'd be having a cocktail down the street or a bottle of rum. So I just want to encourage you, wherever you land, however you land there, find out who landed there and then go find your tribe. Find the places that you find God and go there, please. Philip's dead because I was too arrogant to tell him the truth, and he was too insane to see it. Long story, not for this podium. So I'm in this treatment center, and gratefully, in 1986, they used the big book in their treatment facilities because it's cheaper than writing their own material. And I didn't really know what the problem was. I thought the problem was my behavior when I drank. But they invited me to take a look at my life and my drinking history in light of the doctor's opinion. And I began to understand. I understood that I have something physically wrong with me, that when I take a drink, I take another drink every single time. And I left that facility knowing that I could never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And I was done. I quit. Mama gave me a place to live. She paid off all of my bills up to and not including the copay on that treatment center and gave me a place to live because she wanted me to start with a clean slate. My boss that I was working for on that second shift job held my job for me so the insurance would pay. I came back to work. He said, if you'll show up, don't lay out, don't call in, don't be drunk on the job, then I'll give you a quarter an hour raise at the end of 30 days. And a quarter an hour was a big deal of money. Still is. And I was done drinking. 3 weeks later, and they're out of town, and I bust open the liquor cabinet that they put a padlock on to help me. And there I am, drink in hand, pounding on the counter, wondering how I got started again. Oh, well, I'll stop on Monday. Next month. And that started a two-year, very short for some, but too long for me, program of in and out and in and out and in and out. I surrender, I quit, I'm done. Because I understood what happened when I drank alcohol. That's powerlessness. And I couldn't stop taking the first drink. I'm working at a bar and happy hour bartender and janitor, because that's what I had risen to in my professional career, right next to the Trailways bus station where we sold half pints to the people just like me that were traveling through town and on a layover. And this fella started showing up at my bar, happy hour, drinking Sprites and being happy. Oh, good. You know what it means when the speaker looks at his watch, right? Nothing. Yeah, thank you, Tom. I love that one. At this point, I'm working at the happy hour bartender, and from 5 until 9, I come in there in the morning and I start cleaning up the puke from the night before, and then I open the bar up at 5 o'clock and I do controlled drinking until 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock, depending upon the night, and that's where I drink just enough to keep the screaming heebie-jeebies off of me, but not enough to mess up my cash register and lose my bar tab, because first things first, And at 10:01, I come out from behind that bar and I come around and I sit down and I start drinking the way that I drink. And by 10:30 or 11 or 11:30, I'm passed out on the sofa in the back room of that bar. So drunk, I ought to sleep the clock around. Hour, 2 hours later, I'm back up, madly searching for another drink, making promises that I will keep, and doing whatever I got to do. And you know you may have a problem when you come to in the morning and you go, oh, this is what that alley looks like. Where are my shoes? Damn, they got my, well, it doesn't matter. I didn't have a driver's license or any cash. And, oh, God, I wet myself. Oh, I hope it was me. I was living in a little shotgun duplex in Chisholm because I couldn't stay at Mama's and I couldn't afford rent, and she would pay the landlady my rent, and sometimes she'd bring me groceries. And she just didn't want to see me die on the street, you know? And I'd sometimes get really honest with where my life had ended up, and I wasn't sure what had happened. I'm quite certain it was my mother's fault. And I'd begin to pray to a God that I had lost all contact with. Please just let me die. I can't do this anymore. Life sucks. And God heard my prayer. My executioner's name was Bill Kay, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that never lectured me or made me feel belittled or less than. He just showed me sobriety in action. And then he tricked me, and I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. He's sneaky bastard. Anyway. And after the meeting, he took me back to my bar, and I got drunk. And the next night, he took me to the Froggy Bottom group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after the meeting, he took me back to my bar, and I got drunk. Because he carried the message, and he carried me to the message. And what I did with it was none of his business. And he absolutely believed that I had to come to the conclusion that he couldn't make me do it. The next night, he took me to the Young People's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Montgomery, Alabama, and I did the chip system there. And after the meeting, this is a white chip, the The color signifies surrender. This is not a truce. This is absolute, unconditional surrender. When you take a white chip, you start a new way of life. You start to become a winner. Does anybody want a white chip? And one more time. I got up and I walked up there and you bring them all back, Cushing. We'll melt them down and make you a plaque. And after the meeting, we all held hands, and how they could grip my hand, the sweat and the shame that was just oozing out of me. And then they all stood on that side of the room and looked at me on this side of the room. That's what it felt like. I mean, they were everywhere and talking to each other. I hate it when people don't talk to me because, you know, then it's not about me. And this little Irish fella, Dave Kay, came walking across the room, and he didn't have one of those. He said, "Welcome home." And he put his arms around me. And for just a moment, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, whoo, everything's well now. But for just a moment, I felt like I could be there. That you would let me be there. And I don't know about you and the way you drank and where you drank, and we've all got our own path to get here, but it had been a long time since I had felt safe, even in a locked room, all by myself. And for just that heartbeat, I felt safe. He didn't want nothing from me. He just wanted me to be there. What a gift. And so I started going to meetings. And I started going to Shoney's, and I started going bowling, and I started hanging out with Nancy after hours, and we're, you know, cooking and swapping lies the way I was grooming. And you'll notice there's a couple of words interestingly missing from that description of my early life back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Steps, traditions, sponsorship. I mean, don't get me wrong. Mike C., big, big, big heart, and I liked him a lot, and I thought he could, you know, be a nice guy, and so I asked him to be my sponsor, and he gave me my phone number. So I had a phone number. I didn't call it, but, you know, I was getting there, and one thing leads to another, and I'm up at the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous in Nashville, Tennessee, Labor Day weekend, 1988, and it's a marathon meeting on Friday night on 2 a.m., 4 gallons of coffee, no food, no sleep. Yay! And sometime earlier that week or 2 weeks before, I don't know when it started, but that little thing that crawls up my back and starts talking to me had started talking to me, and I'd shake it off. No, I'm not drinking. Can't have the first drink. And it'd go away for a day or two, and it'd come back, and it'd say, you know, nobody would notice. No, I'm not going to take a drink. And it'd come back and say, well, you could go back to AA on Monday. No. Notice there's some words missing here, like phone call or prayer or... And I'm sitting up at this marathon meeting, and it had started bringing out the big guns. Who do you think you're kidding? You're never going to stay sober. You're a loser. And I knew it was the truth. I knew that it didn't matter that I wanted to not be a drunk no more. I knew it didn't matter that I went to AA meetings. I knew that it didn't matter what I wanted or what I believed or what I dreamed of. I was going to take a drink, and there was nothing I could do about it. I've never felt so helpless and so angry and so alone and so powerless in my entire life. And I surrendered. Let me rephrase that. And I was surrendered. I was broken. And I sat in that marathon meeting, and I said, if this is sobriety, you can have it. This sucks. I didn't say it that nice. And two gentlemen, right after that meeting ended, they didn't interrupt the meeting to treat my sickness. They waited till the meeting ended, and then as I'm bolting for the door, and they kind of cornered me. You people are so good at that. And And they took me to the hospitality room to get me more coffee, because that's what I needed. Secret, it's not really the steps, it's the coffee. And that's not true. That's not true. And they began to share with me stories out of their life. And they saw that I was a little depressed, so they dwelt on some of the horrors that had come. And then they sort of lightened it up and told me some funny antics out of their drinking histories and encouraged me to share some of mine. I don't know where they got that idea. And I began to understand that I was just like them, that they were just like me. And they weren't anymore. They began to share with me what their life was like today. And they didn't talk to me about God. I don't know how they knew, or maybe they didn't. When I was 14 years old, it was made perfectly clear to me that God didn't love me. I was anathema. And so I said, well, you don't like me, I don't like you more. They talked to me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a program of action. They explained to me that what I had was not sobriety. They did it in a loving manner. I always make a joke about that, but they were just very clear to say, this is not what it's like. This is untreated alcoholism. There's hope. So if you're sitting here and that voice has been talking to you and telling you that you can't never stay sober, no how, because you're a loser or whatever it says, and you're feeling as though you're about to come apart at the seams, but you don't want to take a drink, please grab one of those people whose hand was up at the beginning. Say, help me. Grab me. Lord, I could use it. And let me assure you that what you're living through is the insanity, the sadness of alcoholism untreated, whether you're drinking or not. Not drinking never cured nothing that was wrong with me. It made it very apparent. It made it felonious in some cases, but it never treated it. And they began to share with me this miracle that had happened in their life, and I came to believe that maybe, just maybe, the 12 steps of an Alcoholics Anonymous could work for me too. And they held out their life. And they were happy, joyous, and free. They held out my life. I wasn't. They said, which one do you want? And I made a decision. And it was that simple. I had to go back and do lots of other stuff later, but that day it was that simple. What do you want? And I wanted what they had, and I was willing to do anything. And we got down on our knees and we said a prayer to a God that I hated in a room full of people staring at us and didn't do nothing. But I haven't had a drink since. We got up from our knees and they said, now go home, get a sponsor, get a big book, and get to work, because you only made a decision. And I went home to Montgomery that weekend, and I got a sponsor, and I got a big book, and I got to work. And I began to walk through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and life began to change. I want to talk to you a little bit about that change. And gratefully, based upon my experience this weekend, I have a few minutes left to do it. Because if it was just about not taking a drink, I won. I'm done. It's great. Life is wonderful. I don't drink. I remember at that time I was working as a salesman in a computer store because I had told them I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I wasn't, and now that I was sober in the program, or beginning to get sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still there. And every day at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, they were popping beer in the back room, and I was sitting up front listening to it, and I don't remember what happened, but I probably let my mouth overload my position, and Jim fired me. And then 2 minutes later, because he was magnanimous and bought lots of rounds of drinks at the bars, he came back in and he rehired me. And because somewhere or somehow I had let something come into my life that allowed me to know certain things, even though I didn't know I knew them, I said, no, thank you, Jim. I think it's best that I leave. And I drove away from that job, not knowing what I was going to do or where I was going to go, but knowing that I was going to be okay. That is an amazing place when I know that everything I just burned down, I'm going to be okay. Over the last 29 years, there have been many instances where I stood there looking at what I had just burned down. Because I don't know about you, but I still like to start a fire every now and then. Or maybe even somebody else burned it down, but I gave them the matches. And even in the midst of it, when I collect my thoughts or collect my breath, I know it's going to be okay. I got a job working in because I had learned computers, so I got a job working in at Herf Jones, the yearbook people down there in Montgomery. And I want to tell you that, and I only bring this up because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still a high school dropout. I have a GED now. I mean at that point. And so I get this job for like, you know, $8 an hour, which is phenomenal money for me. And it's 1988, so that's not, you know, terrible money. And I'm doing work in graphics on a Macintosh computer because I knew about desktop publishing. 2 years later, when things were getting crazy at Herf Jones, because I'm still, you know, selfish, self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I don't ever want to think it's just 100 forms of fear. It's evenly divided depending upon the day. I was about to get fired, so I gratefully had a call and said, how much would it cost me to hire you? Anybody here ever get that call? I mean, is that not the freakiest call? They've not even done an interview. Somebody told them about me, and they offered me a job. Said, pay me a penny more than I'm making now, and I'll come to work for you. If they'd have paid me a penny less, I'd have probably still done it. But, you know, I want to drive a hard bargain. And so I'm working as the graphic designer in a commercial print shop, a career that I followed for the next 15 years. And I remember the day that on that position, Daryl came to us and said, we have to close the shop. I can keep you on the payroll for 2 more weeks, and then we're going to work you until all the work is out of the building, but I'll have to pay you under the table because the IRS is seizing everything. And I I was actually more horrified for him than I was for me. I don't know how that happens. That's not the way it's supposed to work. And so I worked on that, and I found a job down the street. Like, you know, I took 2 weeks vacation and found a job down the street doing the same thing at more money and with more responsibility. And as I'm nearing the glass ceiling, because I don't know about what you know about commercial printing, but it's kind of in a strange place right now because, you know, everything's electronic. And so I had an opportunity to open up at a company in Montgomery, and today I'm the director of marketing and creative services for a $60 million a year company. Not a big company, but a large company. I sell drugs for a living. I mean, to nursing homes for licensed people to distribute, but it's fun. So I'm living in Montgomery, and I'm living in the garage apartment behind my mother's garage. It's a one-room thing, and then I'm sharing a room with another member of the fellowship because he had some extra room and he could use some capital, and he liked helping. I'll get back to that. And so I'm living there, and then, you know, he gets married and moves off to Birmingham, and so I get a little apartment, and then I fell in head over heels in heat, and so we got a little apartment, and then we got a trailer, and then we got a smaller apartment just for me because I was moving out, and then I fell in head over heels in heat, and we didn't get an apartment together, but we dated each other for, you know, almost 6 months. I mean, we were practically old-time married at that point, and then we fell out of love or something. I don't remember what happened with that one, and then I fell hell over heels in heat, and that one was a newcomer, and that's where I wanted to go because, you know, I was brought up, my sponsor's name was Nan, and she used to say that dating a newcomer is like raping a cripple. Sure, you can do it, but why would you ever want to do that? And I absolutely agreed with that. And I was head over heels not going to go there. But you know, when I got in the middle of it, that's not what it looked like to me. That's not what it felt like. This was real. This was real. For 2 weeks, it was real. I was 7 years without a drink, 6.5 years working a program of action. I was sponsoring people. I had been serving as GSR. I was active in all three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was completely delusional. And what I wanted was more important than whether you survived. I'm grateful that neither one of us got drunk that time. And we are both clean and sober today. But I stand back up here and tell you that it is really easy to rest on our laurels, to think we got it. When people suggest maybe we want to take a look at it, we say, well, why don't you go take a look at it, you nosy busybody? You don't know nothing. When a trusted friend comes into the rooms and says, I don't know what's wrong with you, but your walk and your talk don't match, and I'm afraid for you. I remember when you crawled in here, woman. Who are you talking to? God, it's easy to go there. As I continued on the journey and I continued in active in service and active in the fellowship, well, I completely skipped a major part. Let me go back. I was working with Nan, and I'm up at the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with a God that we hate, or with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You take your pick. And because I believed the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were my solution, I knew that I had to get through this somehow. But because I knew that God hated me, I knew that I couldn't go there. Because I believed, just what I believed would keep you as far away from God as you could get to. And so that's when I really got active in service, because you told me when I got here, if I'd stayed in the middle, I wouldn't fall off when I fell down. And so I'm carrying around 12 and 12s in service manuals, and I'm beating people up left and right with their information that I didn't understand at all. And I'm running, absolutely running. And somebody finally said, stop it. If you're having trouble with a step, back up. And they backed my silly butt all the way up to the third step and the fourth step. I'm resentful at God. That son of a... I'm fearful of God. And I'm utterly ashamed in the presence of God. And I wrote it all down. I got it all out. It was his fault. He wanted too much. And I went and I shared that with God and with myself and with another human being. And I found something out. I was wrong. I like that. I didn't used to like that. God never wanted anything from me. God wanted everything for me. God had been trying to give me all my life. And I kept saying, no, thanks, I'd rather have that. I love, there's a common expression I sometimes hear in the rooms, and it's, you know, if I'd gotten what I deserved. I am finally getting what I have deserved all my life. That I said, no, thanks, I'd rather have that. Because I'm a beloved child of a loving Creator that manifests itself in our lives and in our presence in many different ways, and I don't begin to pretend to understand that. But I absolutely know it. And every time that I'm looking for God, if I will just go and connect with one of his kids, where that in me connects with that in you, there's God. And I'm aware. I began to walk through 6 and 7 again instead of not wanting to ever be him again. Anybody here walk through 6 and 7 just determined not to be him again, whoever he or she may have been in your life? And all of a sudden it opened up to me that look at what I can become. There's no end. There's no limit. I can become what God would have me be. Before this meeting started, a new friend of mine allowed me to pray with him. My Creator, I'm not willing that you should have all of me, good and bad, all of my hopes and my dreams and my wants and my desires, everything that would make my life beautiful. You choose, you decide, because my picker is just really bad. And all of the bad I give to you to teach me how to straighten it out. I got an opportunity to start making amends to my parents, and that ended when I was 11 years sober, and I was down at a group in Mobile, Alabama, and I was speaking, and it was the first time they ever came to hear me speak. Feel sorry for them by now, don't you? And I made my mother cry one more time, tears of joy, because not only did we survive, and not only did we not have to live this way anymore, but now we could actually help somebody else. What a gift. And I got up from the table or the podium, and I held my father's hand and I held my mother's hand, and we said the Lord's Prayer. And my father was no longer 30 feet tall, and my mother didn't love my sister more than me. I don't know how it changed them. They'd forgiven me years before. But it changed me. And I could see my parents. And 2 years later, mother had her stroke. While she was recuperating, Daddy, it became apparent that he had begun that process. And so the nursing homes and the assisted livings and the memory care places and the daycare and the insanity and the lost cars and the disappearing and the reports on television about looking for the old man. And the last 2 years of his life, he was allowed to live with me. When I owed amends to my parents, I owed them amends in excess of $200,000. I don't know exactly what the number was. And when my father needed a place to live, my mother and my sisters got together. And despite who I was, and despite what I had done, because of you people and what you had done for me and with me and to me, they handed me my father and the checkbook. And they said, "Would you take care of your dad?" And because of the change that you people had wrought in my life, when it came time to pass that back, because my father had gone on to the next stage of his journey, I hadn't even borrowed any of his money. He didn't buy my dinner. I made his dinner, and I got to read to him Dickens and David Copperfield. God, he loved that. I don't think he even knew what I was saying. And when my father died, he didn't know who I was. But I knew who he was because of you and the grace of God. And then I turned my attentions to my mother, who's been battling cancer, and my dad running her over with a golf cart, and all of the insanity of getting older. And my sister is taking her to the medical appointments and the insurance and, you know, all the fun stuff. And I'm just taking her to places like Calico Fort and Greenville and out to lunch and dropping the top on the Miata and cruising down and letting her play with the dogs. So she loved me more than my sister. And when we were flying into Philadelphia that day, because she was going to go see her first great-granddaughter celebrate 1 year birthday and be christened in the Catholic Church, but we don't talk about that. And she had the seizure on the plane. And she bit her tongue, but we didn't know where the bleeding was coming from because she was just seized. And you know, they're in descent into Philadelphia, and thankfully there was a doctor on board. And I'm standing there. If you've never landed in an airplane standing up, it's just hysterically fun. And she goes immediately to ICU, where they're putting blood units of blood into her, and she's in and out and in and out and in and out. I went to the birthday party and the christening, and she didn't. And we got her the van, the take her back to Montgomery, and she indicated that she was done. And we called in hospice. And my heart broke again. But because you people told me to suit up and show up, I sat there with that woman who I had put through hell. And I held her hand. And I allowed her to find the grace and the dignity that she needed. And when it was done, you people wrapped me in your loving arms. And you said, "Welcome home." As I fell apart. I remember when I was about 2 years sober, I dropped a bunch of weight unexpectedly. And I didn't know what was wrong, but because of my history and my lifestyle, I had to go get some blood work done, and it took 2 weeks in those days. And so the first week is just keep on going, trucking. And the second week, every day, it's just getting a little bit more. And as it grows in my head, and I know I'm going to die, and I know what he's going to tell me, and I just can't stand it. Why stay sober? What point is it anyway? And I'm driving to get the results, finally, and I'm slinging snot all over the dashboard of that Toyota, and I couldn't see the road, and I pull over to the side of the street on West Jeff Davis, and I close my eyes, and I said, God, please, whatever he tells me, just don't let me take a drink. And I understood first things first. Gratefully, that day, I got positive results that I was absolutely certain that I wasn't going to get. But more importantly, I knew where my strength was. And I've drawn on that strength again and again and again in my life and in my love and in my heart. I draw on that strength today. I'm 55 years old now. Health isn't good. Lots of pains every time I wake up. I got a sty coming up on my eye and got a little bit of a toothache going on. Everybody, 1, 2, 3. Aww. We'll be catering the pity party later. And somebody gives me a call and invites me to come to Florida for a convention, a conference. And I say, sure, I'm free that week, and I'll be happy to. And so I drive down here, and I was supposed to come down here with my partner, but we're de-partnered. And so I grabbed a guy whose sponsor is a guy that I sponsor, and I said, get in the car. And so Bud's been down here this weekend with me and got lit on fire. He's the alternate GSR of my home group. I didn't tell you earlier, my home group is the We Stopped in Time Young People's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I am still delusional. I thought I was going there to babysit them. I turned out to be exactly the opposite. And so he's gotten lit on fire by some of the service discussions that have been going on this week. And so I thank you, because I have a feeling that when we get home, if he'll put into action what he's heard this weekend, that we're going to have a much stronger and much more effective group. And I can still sit in the back and just... And in the meantime, I've met old friends. Conference and from my home groups and my home district and people that I've been on the road with. And God, I just look out at you people, and you're here. And every time I walk into these rooms, whether I'm on top of the world or I'm at the bottom of the dump, because it still goes, you know. It's life. We go to Florida. And thank you. And every time I walk into these rooms, whether it's my home group or the area assembly or a conference, I feel as though you have just wrapped your arms around me and said, welcome home. And I thank you. I thank you for my sobriety. I thank you for my life. And I thank you not for loving me until I could love myself, but for loving me until I could learn to love you. I love you. Good night.